Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We get out of the studio and onto the road to find the kind of radio you don't hear so much anymore. Stories off the beaten path and usually away from the top headlines. We figure the weekend is a good time for that. Time to lean back a little, slow down, meet somebody interesting, hear what people are saying. Of course, when we're not on the radio, you can catch up with us on Facebook. Just search Indiana Weekend. And we'd love to hear your thoughts about the show, your comments, thoughts about whom we might talk with, or where you would like to hear our microphones. Our email address is, conveniently enough, indianaweekend@gmail.com. I'm John Strauss. In today's show, two very different views of life. From Indianapolis, we'll talk with Matthew Tully about what he learned while spending a year with students and teachers in an inner-city school. In Muncie, the life of the firefighters at Station 2 on the South Side, and the Ball State music background of one fire official. To start, let's climb aboard a fire truck. The alert tones have just sounded at Fire Station 2, and this is what it's like when you climb aboard for an emergency run. Within seconds of getting the call, a person struck by a car, we're in the truck.
Fire truck 2, 12th and Madison. This will be 1050 car pedestrian. I have your patient. He's in unconsciousness, suffering a head injury.
There are usually four on a truck, a sergeant who drives and operates the equipment once they get to the scene, an officer who also sits up front, and two back-end firefighters who sit in the back and are usually the younger members of the team. I'm in the back of truck two, and we're headed toward a nearby corner where an older man has been struck by a car. It's nighttime. Bystanders are helping to comfort the injured man as the firefighters arrive. Their job is to stabilize him until an ambulance can arrive.
Well, we were eating dinner and we got a call at 12th and Madison. We had a victim get hit by a car walking across the street. And that's really about all we know right now. Loading him in the ambulance and heading to the hospital with him.
How often does this happen?
It just varies. You may have three or four a day, or you may have one a day. You know, you never know.
When you come to a scene like this, what is it that you all do?
Well, first of all, we make sure we get everybody here safe, and then once we get here, we try to set up our medical crew around them and provide what medical stuff we can do for them until the ambulance gets here, until we can get them transported to the hospital.
So you're the firefighters, you're the first people here.
First responders, yes.
When somebody's injured, and what's on your mind as you're rolling up to that?
Trying to get them help as quick as we can until we can get some more assistance.
It's a Friday night. Talk about just some of the Friday nights that you've worked and what they're like.
Friday nights are usually a little busier as far as traffic accidents. Over the years, you're on the weekends, Friday, Saturdays, they're pretty busy. I'm Sergeant Jim Grace, and I've been on the department 31 years. And I drive truck two, which you're on tonight, and I make try to get our crew here safely and get them back safely.
I haven't followed. You're gonna have to jump on the scene. I'm driving. Cap's gonna stay
we'll follow you out. Okay. Right now, we're getting ready to go to IU Med Center. They're going to transport the patient, and we're going to follow them out.
Captain Eric Wilson is in charge of training.
Is there a time that you're really glad that you were in this service?
It's one of those things that you understand the risks going into it, and I think for me personally, when my career started, it wasn't necessarily, I was still pardon the expression, young and dumb. So, you know, the adrenaline factor of fighting fire and that kind of thing was appealing to me at the time. It, you know, it's definitely an extreme sport at that point in time until you get on the job and you realize the reality of the situation. But I think the thing that bothered me was never fighting fire. It was never the dangerous times. Most of the times when you're in that kind of danger, a lot of times it's after the fact, after everything has happened so quickly. You're sitting on the tailboard of the truck, the situation's kind of calmed down, and it's like, I could have died just then. And that's when the sobering reality kind of hits you. I think the fear that I had going into fire service wasn't for me personally. It was, what if I lose somebody when I shouldn't? What am I going to do in this situation if, you know, that's a lot of responsibility to shoulder? Those were the fears that I had coming into it more than anything.
I just want to touch on this briefly, but as of December, you're Dr. Wilson now.
Yes, that's correct. It doesn't really have anything to do with the fire service. My degree programs were in music. I've been fortunate to be a part of the fire service because it's allowed me to go back and do those kinds of things.
What did you get your PhD in, and what was your dissertation, or what was your area of study?
It's actually a Doctor of Arts, and it's in music theory and composition with a secondary area in voice. My dissertation, I set 18 of Longfellow's sonnets for solo voices and orchestra.
Do these two interests ever cross? Could you imagine writing a symphony for the fire service?
Yes, they do cross. As a matter of fact, there's a piece that I'm writing right now called Manning Street. And it's specifically about the fire that I described with the backdraft situation. It's a programmatic piece, which means that it's got a storyline. But it's kind of esoteric in that it uses, I'm scoring it for string quartet and electronically recorded sounds that are all derived from things that would have happened on the fire ground that night. Manipulations of siren sounds, bells, different things that happened on the fire ground as well. So yes, that has crossed. I've also been asked to sing many times for different events as and in my capacity as a firefighter. So it's always a pleasure to serve in that capacity as well.
That's Captain Eric Wilson of the Muncie Fire Department. More from the firehouse later in the show. Just ahead, lessons from an Indianapolis high school, what a newspaper columnist learned from a year writing about the challenges and triumphs at Manual High School.
Indiana Weekend with John Strauss, Real Radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com.
Matthew Tully, columnist for the Indianapolis Star, spent an entire year observing life at Manual High School in that city, an urban school beset by enormous challenges. He's written a book called Searching for Hope, Life at a Failing School in the Heart of America. He met some remarkable people, including some of the staff and teachers.
My favorite, and he's a big part of the book, is a guy named Spencer Lloyd. When I met him, he was a 25-year-old teacher, second-year teacher, heads the choir department. From a place called Farmtown, Indiana, now was in the heart of the state's largest school district.
I was just going to say, Farmtown to Indianapolis,
and arrived at school with big dreams and big expectations for his students. And I walked into his class early in the school year and just loved it. I mean, I often joke that I'm a great teacher groupie. I love to watch great teachers in action. I think it's a beautiful thing. It's such a hard job, and it's so amazing to see those, and there are so many of them in our city and country that can just, you know, engage a group of teenagers or even younger kids and get them to try harder and to really care about their class. So Spencer Lloyd really became, actually the title of the book is Searching for Hope, and it's based on Spencer Lloyd's classroom, because there were a lot of very depressing things at the school. I'd sit in a meeting in the social worker or dean's office and listen to, for example, a 14, 15-year-old girl talk about being raped and the fact that the young man who had done it, you know, was never charged and still lived in her neighborhood and would taunt her on her way to school. Or I'd see a 14, 15, 16-year-old kid get arrested and sent to the juvenile jail facility with tears in his eyes. Or I'd see parents who just were really trying, but didn't know what they can do to, you know, to try to pull back their kid from the trouble they were getting into. And so you get depressed sometimes. And so the title is Searching for Hope, because whenever I would get too depressed, I would say, you know what, I'm going to Spencer Lloyd's classroom, and I'm going to sit there for 45 minutes and watch class, because I knew that I would find hope in that classroom, and I knew I would walk out of there feeling better.
What did he do?
You know, he just was full of energy. I mean, just from the beginning of class to the end, he, you know, sang and danced and did impersonations and did anything he could to get kids engaged. More importantly, he told them from the beginning, we are going to be excellent here. I know you haven't heard that a lot in your lives or in your schooling, in a lot of the schools that you've gone to or even in this school. But in this class, we're going to strive for excellence. If you want to be an average choir, you need to walk out that door and go to a different school, because we're not going to be average here. You can be great, and we're going to work to be great. And this is a guy who took over a choir department that had 10 students. And he built it, by the time I met him, to a group of 60. And now it's up to about 80. And now he has a show choir that goes all over the region performing. You know, they were invited to back up Foreigner at a concert, you know, 2 years in a row. You know, he really has grown these kids. I would watch the way they would act in his class, some of them, and act in other classes. And it was like two different kids. And what was different? Well, it was the teacher at the front of the room who told them that, no, I expect a lot of you. We're going to work hard. We're going to have fun. I know you have a lot of issues that you carry to the classroom with you, but I want you to drop it off at the front of the classroom. I know you have to pick it up, those problems up when you leave, but while you're here, let this be your oasis. And also, if you need to talk, if you're having a problem at home or in school or anywhere else, come on, you can talk to me. And he could just relate to these kids, and you would just see how they saw him as a either a big brother or probably a fatherly figure that maybe they didn't have. And you know, just the energy, the excitement, the care that he put into every classroom just inspired me.
There came a time when they were invited to perform at Carnegie Hall in New York, but that's not an automatic slam dunk, is it?
No, absolutely not. It was funny. I was in my office one day, and I got the call from the folks at Carnegie Hall saying, hey, you know, we know you've written a lot about the Manual Choir. Wanted to let you know we've invited them to come perform on, you know, one of the world's most famous stages. So I was surprised that I hadn't heard, because Spencer and I have become friends since I got to know him at the school, and I was surprised that he hadn't let me know about it. So I called him up and said, hey, I hear you're going to Carnegie Hall. And he said, well, yeah, if we could raise $30,000.
$30,000.
Which at a school like this is literally like raising $300,000. I mean, right. You know, this was a choir when I met them. He had an annual budget of $1,000. They didn't have matching uniforms because they couldn't afford them. You know, there's just not a lot of money in this neighborhood or at this school. So one thing I'd found over the time that I'd written about the Manual High School is that people responded so generously every time I wrote about a kid or a program, including the choir program. They would send cards and money to the school. They would show up to events just to support them. So I said, well, Spencer, I'm going to write a column about you and the opportunity that you have, and I'm going to challenge the people of Indianapolis to help you raise some of the money to send you to Carnegie Hall, send your class to Carnegie Hall. So, as I've always said, the columns I've written about Spencer and his class are the easiest I've ever written, because all I have to do is sit in the classroom for a day or two, and I have such wonderful material because he's such a fun teacher to watch. He, you know, he's so inspiring, and then his kids are just really good kids, and they've been through a lot in their lives, but they're trying so hard. So I wrote a column in the Indianapolis Star last March and told people they had this opportunity, but here was their challenge. And by the end of the week, they'd raised $100,000. I mean, people just, not only from Indianapolis, but from the surrounding counties, from the rest of the state, and even outside of the state. You know, thanks to the beauty of the internet, people read about it and contributed so much. So they're going to Carnegie Hall, but they also now have a digital music lab. They have things that you might find in programs and choir programs in wealthier counties, but they just couldn't afford to have here. So it really was a cool experience.
I'm John Strauss, and this is Indiana Weekend, the show that goes behind the headlines for a look at life in our area. Always interested in your thoughts and suggestions, drop us a note to indianaweekend@gmail.com. Recently, we spent a shift with the Muncie firefighters of Station 2 on the south side, and we got a look at everyday life in the firehouse, including dinner time.
Fire Station 2 on the south side of Muncie. Sergeant Craig Knuckles is in the kitchen and has three pans going at once.
Chicken fajitas for tonight, so a little special meal for the guys. We eat pretty well while we're here, but that's one of the advantages we do have, is having the kitchen. So at our station, we take turns rotating through on who's going to cook. We all try to share that job. Go to the grocery, we buy the groceries that we need. We split that amongst all the guys that are here. I'm going to go call these guys for dinner so they don't get upset.
Make sure when you have your physical that you go get your paperwork.
Yeah, we're ready. I'm moving.
There's paperwork that has to be filled out.
Yeah, mine's not filled out.
In between the emergency runs and the everyday life around the station, the firefighters spend a lot of time training. Captain Eric Wilson is a reminder of just how serious the business can be.
There have been several times in the course of fighting house fires that fire will spread through void areas or spaces that you aren't aware of between walls, especially in older balloon type construction where there are no fire stops, or it'll be below you. And it may look perfectly fine in the room that you're in, and then all you need to do is just give it one little breath of air or one little place where it breaks through, and suddenly you're in a wall of flames. It's the way that it happens sometimes. It just, it'll follow the path of least resistance, and it'll keep going as long as there's fuel and oxygen to support it.
What happens when someone has a fire in their house? They wake up?
Many times, especially if it's in the middle of the night, it's already dark to begin with. And fire conditions, the smoke that's produced, really isn't depicted to the general public in a very realistic fashion a lot of times. It's so thick, so black, especially with modern construction. We've got a lot more plastics, which burn dirtier, more dangerously, hotter. The byproducts of the combustion put particles in the air that are thicker. It's not like the old wood type construction where you had clean materials that were burning and you had maybe a little more of a chance. That thick, black, hot smoke is going to be all over. You're not going to be able to see anything. So even a house that you've lived in your entire life becomes a very strange place. It's filled with a lot of strange sounds, the popping, the cracking, that kind of thing if the fire's in close proximity. The smoke is disorienting, not just from the visual standpoint, but as you breathe it in, it also does things that inhibit your the ability of your lungs to take in oxygen, and your system starts to become more disoriented and confused, and the byproducts of combustion are very dangerous things to be breathing in as well. So it's a very disorienting place. It's good to have a plan.
Did there ever come a time where you thought, wait a minute, this is serious? I'm starting to get a little scared now.
Oh, sure. There are always those situations where it's very, very intense. I remember one particular instance. I was the firefighter in the back of the truck, which meant that I'm the guy that goes through first with the hose line. We had a call. It was a small house, relatively small house, of a handicapped individual who was supposedly still inside. And no way to get out. Entrapment, fire was fully involved. At that time, this has been about 15 years ago, at that time we actually kind of broke away from protocol and we abandoned the two-in, two-out rule at that point in time. The lieutenant went through the front, I went through the back. We each had a hose line and we were doing a search for the victim, knowing that other units were en route and would be there within a few minutes. But I'd gone in through the back, and the structure lit up all around me. It was had just gone through its flashover phase, and I would have to actually turn the hose line on to get in, advance in any further. And as soon as I would, it would light up behind me again. So here I'm trapping myself in the middle of this, turned out to be a kitchen area, and there was a gigantic refrigerator circa 1950s or 60s that the floor started to give way and that thing started to rock toward me, and I thought at that point in time I could really buy the farm right here.
That's Captain Eric Wilson of the Muncie Fire Department talking with John Strauss of Indiana Weekend. Is there somebody special you think we should meet, a place or a story that belongs on Indiana Weekend? Drop us a note with your ideas and reactions to indianaweekend@gmail.com.
Matt Tully of the Indianapolis Star learned a lot of things while spending a year at Manual High School in that city. His book is called Searching for Hope, Life at a Failing School in the Heart of America. Tully says he was struck by the generosity of readers, especially when it came to a challenge for readers to help the school's choir program, run by music director Spencer Lloyd.
It really was an island of excellence in the school. And so I decided to kind of team those two things up, you know, writing about my favorite classroom, my favorite teacher, some of my favorite students at the school, but also mix that in with the challenge. And it was the holiday season. Spencer was holding the annual holiday Christmas extravaganza, he calls it. It's this big holiday concert he puts on, in which they usually get tiny crowds, as do most things at the school. They get 50, 60 people, maybe in the audience of 1,000 people. And so I wrote a column about Spencer and his classroom and his students and included a little challenge in there. Said, hey, all of you folks that have reached out to me and said that you want to help, you want to get involved, here's a way. Just show up on Tuesday evening. Just sit in the auditorium and watch a great group of students and show them that people care, so that instead of looking out at 50 people, they could look out at 500 or 1,000. And so I wrote the column. I had no idea what to expect, but in the end, the community responded in ways that I could have imagined. They not only filled the 1,200 seats in the auditorium, but every inch of aisle space. The school at the last moment had to have a second concert because so many people had showed up. They couldn't fit them into the first one. People donated thousands and thousands of dollars, $10,000 that night, another $10,000, $15,000 in the days to come. There were traffic jams outside the school. There were Manual graduates from 20, 30, 40 years earlier who hadn't been in the school since graduating and had tears in their eyes at the idea of supporting their school. I remember one of the teachers called it, said it seemed like a Christmas movie because, you know, you just had the community coming out to support these kids. And it was funny, that night I was on the stage on the side watching the concert, and it really was the first time I noticed that they didn't have matching outfits that you might expect, you know, at a lot of schools.
You might expect choir robes.
Exactly. But they couldn't afford them. They had such a tiny budget for the choir, and they knew the parents couldn't afford to do that. So, you know, they kind of looked like a ragtag bunch of kids, and, you know, some were in jeans, some were in khakis, some were in polo shirts. A couple of girls had dresses on, but you know, I thought it was beautiful, but obviously the choir director would prefer that they're in matching outfits. So they have those now, thanks to the community support, and they have a lot of other things, thanks to the community support. And more importantly, I really do think these kids have a sense of pride and a sense of belief in themselves. I mean, I just saw after that, I'd go into the classroom, and these kids just had so much more, not only energy, because they already had that going in, but they had so much more confidence, you know. And kids that had been kind of shy before, I'd notice were singing a little louder. And I think, you know, not only performing in front of that many people, but then succeeding and putting on a good show really told them that a lot was possible. And, you know, Spencer Lloyd from the first class had told his class, hey, we can be excellent. And I think they saw, hey, we can be great.
I'm John Strauss, and that's our show for today. Glad you could join us this time, and hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Reminder, we also need your stories, ideas for places we should go, and people we should talk to. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Till we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend, I'm John Strauss.